You're listening to the one show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, the frontiers of the new 21st century economy. To explore the latest in sales techniques and technologies, here's your own personal guide, your personal pilgrim on the 405, Will Crist.
Well, welcome to a wonderful, beautiful, sunny day here in Southern California. Lots of puffy white clouds around the mountains. We don't get many clouds like that, so it's interesting. Driving back down the 405 from Redondo Beach and noticed how beautiful it was. We've been suffering from June gloom here, and maybe because July is coming, June gloom has decided to walk away and not be here with us anymore. But we got a couple of very interesting things to talk about today. One, we're going to hear from COO of a local company that's gone through, like the rest of us, this change in the marketplace. And we're going to hear from the COO what kinds of things they've been doing to counter that, what sort of things they've been doing to reinvent themselves. And then after the break, we're going to hear from, we've got an interview from Paris, France. We're going to hear from a developer there about what he's doing to help people clean up their and maintain their contact list in Google Apps. And we're going to hear about what the business climate is in Europe, especially in France. Some very interesting things coming up there. So stick around with us. I want to welcome to the show a fellow who has been working very diligently over the past couple of years to help his company reinvent itself and to come up with new ways of addressing the marketplace and filling the gaps that need to be filled. So I want to welcome Michael Lang from Power Plus. Michael, welcome to Pilgrim Talks.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Well, that's great. We've been looking forward to this. Tell us a little bit about what Power Plus has done and what you're doing now.
Well, I don't want to bore you with a long story, but I'll try and cover some ground starting from the beginning. Back in 1987, we started really as a temporary power company. We incorporated and took a business that was a family business. Steve Bray was the owner. It was his dad's business before that. Took and incorporated it and really had a vision to provide a power solution company, more than just a temporary power company for construction, a power solution company that really provides power, in essence, to many different industries. That was the vision back starting in 1987. And we started to grow in the early 90s, of course. Housing took a dip, nothing like we saw in the end of 2006 and 2007. But certainly those who would remember late 80s, early 90s, it was tough sledding for a while. And then around about 96 through 98, things started to pick back up again, and we added some services to our offering. Not only temporary power, but generator, portable power, utility services, where we're started providing for utility companies such as Southern California Edison, PG&E, San Diego Gas and Electric. And we just started to grow. We averaged about 30% growth year over year through the end of the 90s and through to early 2000, right through to Y2K. For those of you who remember that, the year 2000, the big scare there, we sold a lot of generators then. Into the boom, 2001, 2002 through 2006. And really could not build the company fast enough during that time.
That seems to be true for many folks. They were on such an upward slope that they weren't thinking about what would happen on the other side of that slope. Did you notice that with other business people?
Yes. I mean, of course, there were some that were proactive. We knew that, that having gone through it before in the early 90s, we knew that the building, the trend could not continue. It was just not sustainable. There were other companies that I think knew that, but maybe things were just so good and it was going so fast and furious they just didn't have time to plan. But we did know that it couldn't last forever. And we were working hard during that time to diversify the company and to get into some other areas that were not tied solely to the construction industry.
So tell us a little bit about what you've done. Now your company before was, you did a lot of work with construction. You provided power for residential and commercial development projects, right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, name any of the top builders during that time, and we were doing work for them. Lennar Homes, D.R. Horton, Kaufman & Broad, K.B. Holmes, was Kaufman & Broad, became K.B. Holmes. We did housing was probably 85 to 90% of our business at one point. It was... It really was a time when, if we had to choose it, we wouldn't choose it that way because we were very inefficient. We were running hard, and we were just trying to keep up.
All right, and so that didn't slowly come to a halt. That came to a screeching halt, right?
Absolutely. Fourth quarter of 2006, really, the faucet was literally just shut off. We had done some preparation leading up to that over the course of the years to diversify, so we were not as badly affected as many others were. But still, it was a very large part of our business, and it was difficult for us to replace that business. We were not able to replace it overnight, and we still have not gotten back to the level that we once were.
All right, so with the decline in that particular part of the business, and while that was a major part of your revenue, what did you do when you were faced with that? I mean, it wasn't like you could go out and find other builders because nobody was building. So what did you do to reinvent your business?
Absolutely. We really needed to look at other industries that were not affected as badly with the building industry. That's of course 2007, 2008, and those industries that we looked at ranged from utility-based work surrounding planned outages, and a planned outage is where the utility company will need to do either routine maintenance or repair work on existing facilities, and in order to do that work, they have to cut the power, and in so doing, there will be customers who go for a period of time without power. In those cases, we actually come in and provide portable power. We'll roll generators on site that range from the size of your car to the size of a semi-trailer, depending on the load requirements. And we were able to carve out a nice niche for ourselves in providing that type of work. The need is constantly there. Our facilities, the utilities facilities, are aging and reaching a point where they are requiring more and more maintenance. And since we had been working with the utility companies since the early 90s, and we had been doing design work, and we had been doing actually infrastructure work on their behalf in residential, we were able to navigate those waters without too much difficulty and pick up quite a bit of business there.
And so this was a new idea, wasn't it?
Yes. This is something that we had not targeted before. But as we sat down and we put our heads together and started to lay out on a whiteboard what other industries we could go after, this was definitely one that made sense for us and was right in a sweet spot for our expertise.
All right. Now, that would be a sort of a strategic brainstorming session. And your company has a record of strategic thinking. Tell us a little bit about who's in your office.
But sure. As far as the things that we've done from a strategic standpoint,
But you showed me a guy who's in your office there, sitting in the corner.
Oh, Okay. Well, when this goes way back into the late 80s, we sat down in a room and began to brainstorm and just put some ideas up on a board that addressed the question, who do we want to be when we grow up? And we talked about what are the industries that we want to be in. We talked about what are the services that we want to provide. We talked about what our values were going to be. We talked about what were topics that were important to us. And we just started to lay this out in different categories. And we came up with the idea of providing global utility solutions. And in that vein of providing global utility solutions, we came up with a cartoon that we call Gus. And Gus is, of course, short for Global Utility Solutions. And so we drew this stick figure, this form of a man who is holding up and plugging into the world, and we started to lay out the services in his right arm, the services that we wanted to provide. So we want to provide turnkey services and emergency relief and utility mobilization and transmission, retrofitting, cogen, event power, temporary power. We just started to throw these different things up on a board and talk about them, what services we could provide. And then we talked about the different industries that we would want to be in and further develop. So utility and housing industries and pulp and paper industries and mining industries, and we put those in the left arm. And then across the chest, we talked about what's really our heart and our passion as a company, who we want to be, how we want to be represented. And so we put up on the board that God was first, and teamwork and family and relationship building, that was important to us. Loyalty, flexibility, enjoying our work, having fun, being passionate about what we do, taking risk, winning, operating with integrity, and having a never quit, can-do attitude. And then we came up with our corporate values. We value each and every individual employee. We value our customers, integrity in the conduct of our business, excellence in everything that we do, executing details well. All of this was core. That was the core foundation of our values. And then lastly, the importance of profitable operations, key to any successful business.
Well, it seems to me that
responsibility. Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it seems to me that once you have those core values, beginning with God, going all the way down to persistence.
Yes.
That whole gamut there. If those values stay in your consciousness, if Gus in the corner over there speaks every morning, so to speak, that will help you through both the ups and the downs, won't it?
Oh, Will, you have no idea. There were times, especially through 2008, we faced some just unbelievable obstacles. And we went back to our core many times to really stop and reflect on what was important. We knew protecting the core was absolutely essential, because without that, nothing else mattered. So there were times when we focused on that. We would focus on, all right, we have all these challenges that are ahead of us. We have nothing but bad choices in front of us. How do we make these decisions? And going back to those core values enabled us to make some very, very difficult decisions along the way.
I've talked to many businesses who wound up being, the senior leadership was almost like deer in the headlights. I mean, they didn't know which way to go. wasn't true for you, was it?
No, I think we always knew what needed to be done, and of course we talked about this long before it actually hit us. We had been talking about diversifying the company for many years. Even when we set out to invent ourselves in the very beginning and cast a vision for the company, we talked about providing services and working in industries that we had never worked in before, and services that we had never provided before. So we were well along the way of developing and diversifying the company. When this hit, what we did not necessarily anticipate is it shutting off as quickly as it did for the construction industry. We thought that it would actually be a little bit more gradual. So we did have to scramble a bit, but we didn't have to figure out where we were going and what we were going to do. We already knew what that was ahead of time. We just had to escalate how we executed and how quickly we responded. Having the plan ahead of time was key for us, though.
And as that plan changed, you could go back what you call the core. That's really your values, isn't it?
Yes, the core, our core values drive everything that we do. Whenever we're making decisions, sometimes it's easy to, okay, let's take a step back. You know, we value each and every individual employee. That's first. Without the employees, there would not be a company. There is no business. How does this decision affect them? We are committed to our customers. How does this decision affect them? You know, integrity that in everything that we do. How does this decision relate to that? It's easy for us to use and go back to that, our core values, when we're making decisions. And then, of course, providing power. I mean, essentially, we know our business's power. We know our expertise is in power. And providing power to our customers when they need it and where they need it. That's our tagline, power. When you need it, where you need it. Really, how it gets there and how it's done, the customer doesn't care as long as he can plug into it, because he needs it for something. It could be related to disaster relief. It could be related to emergency backup. It could be related to construction. It could be related to a utility shutdown. The bottom line is the customer needs power. That's all they know. The rest is our business. How we provide it, getting it there in a timely manner when they need it, that's up to us, and that's what we do best.
So having those core values about who you are as a company, when I work with salespeople and sales managers, we call that their identity. Their identity is their set of values, their beliefs about themselves. And it sounds to me like you folks there have a very strong identity about what you do. Now, on the other hand, there's a role. We call that the I and the R. And so you have the identity and you got the role. And roles change, just like marketplaces. And whether the marketplace is good or bad, it doesn't have to affect your identity. And it sounds to me like you folks have a discipline, have a way of getting back to your identity, staying with that identity, regardless of what the marketplace is doing. You know that your role is to supply power, and how you do that's going to change from time to time depending upon what people out there need. Am I getting that right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's one of our greatest strengths is we are willing to change, and we are we operate in a manner where we can be fluid. We give that flexibility to our areas. For example, this is not just one. We don't have one office where we operate a company out of, and I can go out every day and I can make sure that everyone's doing their job and I can give direction. We have many offices across several states. We have 11 offices in California, Arizona, Nevada, Texas, and we have technicians that are across the country that are operating in our service and maintenance group. They are all empowered with these core values, where if they are faced with a decision, they can go back to these core values and they can make that decision knowing that within our core values, our commitment to our customer, meeting the immediate and long-term needs of our customers, our highest priority. So they can look at that and they can say, all right, I have a customer who needs this. It's after hours. I can't get a hold of my purchasing department, but I know that one of our core values is our commitment to our customer. So I am going to make the decision on my own, put this item on my credit card, and I'm going to take care of my customer. Now, in our culture, every single individual employee is empowered to make that decision. And if they make that decision based on that criteria, I will personally stand behind them. Whether it turned out good or it turned out bad, as long as their intention follows that criteria, I will support the decision that they made. That's been key for us.
So they're getting feedback on how well they stick with those values, with the identity of the company.
Absolutely. And it revolves around that commitment, that level of commitment to our customers. See, what we sell, what we provide is not a commodity. It's not a widget, a power widget, if you will. Really, what we are providing is a service. Because the customer really, at the end of the day, could care less about the power widget. They just need their problem solved. Mm-hmm. And as long as I can solve their problem, then I'm providing something of value to them.
Yeah, what their problem is has to do for you has to do around power, maintaining consistent power.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about if you're willing to tell us a little bit more about this planned outage. How did that provide you with an opportunity?
Well, let's say a medical facility, just as an example. A skilled nursing facility or an assisted living facility located in Anaheim, for example, or any city for that matter. I don't want to get necessarily into specific examples. I don't really want to name those customers that we work for, but let's just say it's a skilled nursing facility. They cannot do without power. They do have a backup generator on site. But let's say there's going to be a planned outage that's going to take place for a period of 6 hours, and this is pretty common. They aren't comfortable running on their own backup generator for 6 hours. They want a redundant system standing by just in case. The utility company has notified them of this planned outage. They've given them 3 days' notice. And so they call us and they say, okay, we're going to be without utility power on this day for this period of time, and we need for you to come in and provide a backup for us, or even in many cases, prime power on this day for this period of time. So on 3 days' notice, we'll go out to their location. We'll determine what their power needs are, how we are going to connect. We've got to intercept the utility, what generators, what size generators we're going to bring out to their site, and we'll plan a logistical movement to come out on that day, set the generators, tie into their facility, intercept the utility feed, and switch them over to our power source before the outage occurs, run that and provide that power for the necessary period of time, and then come back after the utility comes back online, remove our equipment, retie them into the utility power, and they're back into business doing what they do.
Well, that's very creative. I mean, you're actually supplying a place where otherwise they would be on their own.
Yes, and being on their own is not an option in the case. In the example I gave you, you can't just move medical establishments. They absolutely cannot be without power.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's very creative. Very creative. Anything else that you've done in the company that you'd be willing to share with us about what you've done to recreate that the role part, how you're addressing the marketplace?
You know, one thing that we've done, and it really kind of started out small and has since grown, is not related to commerce. I had mentioned earlier when you had me talk about Gus, one of the things that was important to us was God and teamwork. So we do quite a bit of work with charitable organizations. When we came into this downturn, our giving, our ability to give in a monetary way was severely hampered. It was limited. There wasn't much we were able to do because really, literally, we were fighting for our lives. However, one thing that we did have as we were right-sizing the business and trying to streamline our operations, we found ourselves with spare warehouse space and spare office space. So what we started to do was open up that spare and available space to organizations that were doing good in the community. Organizations like Urban Youth Mission, they work with our youth in urban settings, downtown LA and many urban cities across the country. Free Wheelchair Mission was another organization that we opened up warehouse space. They have containers that are here, and we do storage as well as some assembly, provide assembly space for them. Truth Ministries, which is a ministry out of India, we provide some storage and staging area for them as well. Mercy Warehouse, which is a warehouse out of Laguna Niguel, and they do food bank and coordinate food bank efforts for the surrounding areas. Firehouse Prayer, which is a prayer group that comes and meets here, uses office space. And CRI, Crisis Response International, they do a crisis response, send out teams into areas that are hit by natural disaster. So that actually started out kind of small. We started out by providing a couple of phone lines and a few desks and to one ministry, and it since has grown quite large. Now that doesn't do anything for us in the way of commerce. That doesn't do anything for us in the way of our bottom line, but it still fits very well within our core values, and it's a way that we can continue to provide for organizations that are working to help others and serve in an area that, you know, where there is great need.
And that certainly fits with your core values, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. We try and stay true to ourselves, and everything that we do really revolves around those core values.
Well, that's wonderful. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us. And I mean, it's an exemplary company that you have, and such a great model of the value of strategic planning. Now, I assume that not every company is going to have God at the top, and you're to be commended for that. Nevertheless, every company needs to have a very clear strategy for who they are, what their core values are, because we're always going to be bumped along in this role and this marketplace, and all of the things that we thought were solid, they keep changing. But when we have that kind of commitment to the core values that you're talking about, it makes it so much easier to move through.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. Is there anything that you'd like to say to the audience? These are fellow business owners, CEOs, salespeople.
Well, really the same thing that I've been telling my people for the last 4.5 years when all this kind of, you know, started going sideways for us. There are always opportunities, no matter what the circumstances are. There will always be opportunities to gain new ground, to move into new territory, to try something new, to provide a service for your customer. There will be a need. It's not going to be the same, though, and it is always changing. But if you approach every challenge with that mindset, that in this challenge lies an opportunity, we just need to find it, you will find it. And use your people. Bring all of the intelligence in your organization. It's all there. Just bring them in a room. Take key individuals from different areas, and you know who they are. Bring them into a room and begin a dialogue and start to talk about things. You will be absolutely amazed what you come up with. I mean, I look back and I have scribble on boards and on the poster boards on the poster paper. I have that on my wall in my office, and I just leave it up because I like to look at it and revisit it. I have scribble from meetings that we've had where I'll go back and I'll look at it and I'll say, you know, maybe at the time it wasn't necessarily pertinent, but it will hit me later and an answer will come from that scribble that I leave on the wall. You'd be amazed how much intelligence is out there in your people. Don't be afraid to bring them into a room and tap into it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking time, and congratulations on having a very clear set of core values there and sticking to it through this sometimes crazy, confusing world. Thanks a lot. We really appreciate it, Michael.
Thank you, Will. Take care.
And there we have a very strongly committed company to the core values that are going to help it through the ups and downs of a marketplace. As things change, their core values don't change, and so they stick with that. And from time to time, I'm sure they get together in a room and take a look at Gus sitting over there in the corner and recommit to those core values. So essential in this crazy time that we're living through. Now, before we get on to our next guest, who is going to be with us from Paris, France, talking about a new software tool that he's created. We want to hear from Sandler Training, and the folks at Sandler Training have a book called 49 Rules of Sandler, and it's available. It's available from Amazon.com. It's available from any Sandler site. It's also available in video format on YouTube and various Sandler sites around. What we'll be doing for the next couple of weeks is hearing one rule, the audio track from one rule each week. So here we are from our friends at Sandler Training.
Hello, this is Bob Anoni with Sandler Training, here to talk to you about rule number one. You have to learn to fail to win. Think about learning how to walk or riding a bike. When you first started to learn how to walk, of course you fell. And you fell again, you fell again, but eventually you mastered the art of walking. Same thing with riding a bike or driving a car or making cold calls or starting up a business. Henry Ford failed four times before he succeeded. Thomas Edison worked almost 10 years on the light bulb before he succeeded. They weren't failures, but they were willing to risk failure to find out what they were truly capable of achieving. At Sandler, we ask you to learn from your failures and understand that the process is failing, not you as a person. You are not a failure. The process that you are using isn't apparently the right one to produce the results that you're trying to produce. So if the cold call isn't going well, we'd ask you to examine the sales process that you're using. Don't get discouraged if your sales call doesn't go well. Learn from it. So again, Sandler rule number one is you have to be willing to fail and risk failure in order to win, to find out what you're truly capable of achieving.
Well, welcome back to Pilgrim Talks on this interesting, cloudy, sunny afternoon in Laguna Beach, California. We have a very interesting conversation coming up this afternoon with a fellow from France. Just clicking around the internet, I came up with this very interesting tool called Write That Name from Quagga. Now, Quagga was founded with the vision of combining advanced machine intelligence with a beautiful customer experience to deliver smarter emails at the right time in the right place. And what Write That Name does is it takes the email address from people that I write to, and it goes out to the internet and picks up all the contact information and then drops it into my Google Apps Gmail contacts account. And so I called up Philippe Laval from France to talk a little bit about what's going on in France about business, what Quagga is all about, to talk about the value of Write That Name for people in Southern California. So from France, let's welcome Philippe Laval. Welcome, Philippe.
Yes, hello. Welcome, Will. Thank you for the invitation.
You're wonderful. Wonderful. Tell us a little bit about how you got into Quagga.
Well, this is not my first company. Before this, I had a corporate search engine, so we were already dealing with information overload. And I saw that you get so many emails each day that it's becoming a pain to handle all of this. And then we founded Quagga 2 years ago to use semantic technology to build a kind of virtual assistant for your email, something that will help you decide which mail you still have to answer. That is your address book up to date? Did you forget a meeting? Just like a virtual assistant for your email.
So now I didn't even know about the keeping my calendar up to date. Tell me about that.
Well, it's a feature that's going to come. Our first... Well, we did two features first. One is Write That Name, which keeps your address book up to date. And the other one is Gmail Smart Reminder, which is a Chrome extension that tells you which mails you have to answer because there are requests in it, on which people you should ping again because you ask them something, and maybe they forgot about you or something like that.
Okay. So how did you – what's your background?
Well, I started in computer science a few years ago. I'm around 40 years old. And I moved to linguistics, like how you can analyze language to extract key meanings from sentence. And I worked in a private laboratory for a few years. And then I founded my first company, Sinequal, kind of a corporate search engine, which deals mainly with French newspaper and military intelligence to extract information from secret information, that kind of thing. And after this, which was pretty successful in France at least, I moved again to create Quagga with a small team of natural language specialists.
And now, I'm curious, is your team local in Paris or are they around the world?
No, it's a local team in Paris, and we have many nationalities there, but they're currently all based in Paris.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, what has it been like introducing Quagga tools like Write That Name? Has it been a global release or is it local?
No, it's a global release. Everything we do is both in French and English. Actually, about two-thirds of our users are from your side of the ocean, from the United States. So we really want to do something which is both in Europe, and specifically in France, and in England and the United States.
All right. What do you use to market your tools?
Well, it's really difficult because, we're in France, we're pretty good software engineers. We're not really good at marketing things, that kind of thing. So we're using our website. We're using direct contact to bloggers. We were very lucky to be part of something which is called SeedCamp, which is a bit like Y Combinator, but it's based in London. And they help us a lot about doing viral marketing, that kind of thing.
And they helped you with viral marketing?
Yeah. So we're retweeting a lot. Our users are helping us a lot by... talking about our product, that kind of thing. We're seeing a small but very sustainable viral growth around Write That Name.
And do you have any tools that you use to track who comes to your website?
Yeah, we're using something which is called dashboard.io, mm-hmm. which is done by Dev McClure and 500 Startups. And we're using the very classical tools like Google Analytics and that kind of things. But Dashboard.io is really very useful.
I was speaking with somebody last week, interviewed a fellow from Lead Forensics. He's in the UK. You might take a look at that.
Leeds Forensics, okay.
Leeds Forensics.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I'll do that.
He's got a very interesting way of finding out who, in terms of business, who is on your website using IP addresses.
Yeah, I think I read something about them. Yeah, it seemed really interesting. Currently, our product is more B2C or B2Prosumer product, so we're targeting the individual. But it's true that in something like 3 weeks, we release a corporate version where you can use Red Zat name inside your corporation and register all your users in one go. Also, at this point, we'll be really interested. We'll probably go through the Google Apps Marketplace since we're very linked to Gmail and Google Apps.
But very good.
Any tools will help us. Yeah.
Very good. Well, I'll introduce you to the founder of Lead Forensics after the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think you both would find it very interesting to talk. All right, so tell us a little bit about the creative marketplace, the development marketplace in France.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So we're based in Paris. You know, France is very centralized, so almost everything happens in Paris. There is a strong startup scene, mostly technical. I think we French guys are mostly very technical people, software engineers, that kind of thing. We see a lot of companies in the e-commerce business. You know, we have very big success in e-commerce like Vente Privée or Mythic in the dating space. Mythic, we just merged with Match.com. And we have venture capitalists is not as active as it is in the Silicon Valley, but we still have a pretty strong community. The nice thing is that we get a lot of help from the government, which it's something which is probably very strange for you American guys. But we get a lot of funding, grants, that kind of thing from the French government that helps small companies, startups, as long as they do very technical stuff. So I would say it's pretty active, very technical. We're not so good at marketing our own products, so usually we team up with some American people to do that. And we have some nice company like Business Object, which was bought by SAP last year. Mythic, which just merged with Match.com. Vente Privée, which is expanding its business to the United States. I would say, obviously, not as active as Silicon Valley, but still, it's a pretty good place to create a company.
What about the internet access? What kind of...
Oh, internet access is really good. You know, we have broadband access all over the country for something like $35 per month. You have full broadband access with what we call triple play, meaning you have internet TV, you have full voice over IP, and you have a very, very good connection. So internet access is really good. I think it's something like, there are something like 60 million people in France. And I think something like 45 million of them are connected with broadband access. It's really good.
Wow.
Really good. Yeah, it's something we're pretty good with. You know, it's all those technical people. Government, telco, and that kind of thing can be useful from time to time.
Yeah, yes, indeed. That's part of the controversy here in the States is... to what degree should government be involved with business, and to what degree should it be completely free? And
yeah, it's every country has its idiosyncrasies. So I think we have to take what we have. So the nice part is we get a lot of help. The not so nice part is there is a lot of regulation. It's really complicated to hire people. If you have to fire some people, it's really complicated in France too. So. There is some good and some bad, like probably everywhere.
Different ways of doing it.
Yeah, exactly. No, the thing which is really clear is that you can't start in France, but once you're big enough, you have to go. You have to go to Silicon Valley. I mean, at least if you are in the internet business.
So France is to some degree is like a skunk works.
Probably, yeah. I know there is talk about. Doing things like Silicon Valley in other parts of the world, even in other parts of America, like Boulder or Silicon Valley in New York, we have the same question here. I think you really can start here because you have a lot of help, but then the market is too small. And access to big money, big funding is not good enough in France. So you have to move to the to America at one point.
Is there is the European Commonwealth, is that a helpful to business?
You know, it's probably helpful, but probably not to startup, because even with a single market, you still have something like 25 different languages in which you have to localize your application. And then the people are really different from country to country. So the buying habits from a German guy or a Greek person is really different. So I would say that usually what you do is you start in one country and you move to America, where you have a single unified market. Mm-hmm. I think the European market is very good for big corporations, like people from Total or Alcatel-Lucent, or those kind of people. It's really helpful. From small company like us, it's anyway, it's too complicated.
Well, what I'm finding in interviewing, speaking with CEOs of you know, $100, $200, $400 million companies in the United States, is they are beginning to see Europe, Asia, and Latin America as not only places to outsource manufacturing or call centers or other administrative kind of thing. They're also beginning to see this as a very strong marketplace to begin to seek consumers.
I think it's true for, as you said, corporations that have reached a certain size. I think for a startup, it's really complicated. It was really interesting to listen to the CEO of Meetic. So Meetic is just like Match.com. It's same size, same business model. Just it was based in Europe, where Match.com started in America. And the CEO from Meetic said, to build this company, I had to localize my service in 25 languages. I had to merge with 5 different companies. I have to do it in, he started before the euro. I had to do it in 20 different currencies. Whereas to build Match.com, you had one market, one language, one money. So yes, Europe is a big market. It's becoming more unified, but there is still a lot of cultural difference between, I don't know, Ireland or Austria. It's still very, but it will come to that. I'm very confident in the fact that it will be one of the 3 biggest markets with Asia and the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that we get surprised, frustrated, and embarrassed when we see the split between the red states and the blue states and the conservatives and liberals, you know, that kind of difference. But you are immersed in that kind of cultural difference with 25 different perspectives.
Yeah, and 12 different languages and 25 different regulations about how you can deal with private life and can you put cookies, not cookies, on the website. Germany is very strict. France is less strict about this. So, no, really, I think the logical step for any European startup, once it has attained a critical size on its own market, domestic market, is to move to America.
Well, we have space over here. I'll put a sign out for an apartment for you.
Thank you.
I'd love ready. To. Sure. Now, let me ask you a little bit about what you see in the future for Quagga. What kinds of things do you see happening?
What I see, what we're building is, we're really building a virtual assistant. So what we, if you look back something like maybe 10 years ago, probably it was the same on your side. 10 years ago, most knowledge worker had private assistants or personal assistant. Now it's over. I mean, even if you are an executive, you probably don't have a private assistant. So our vision is that in a few years, you'll have virtual private assistant, which will be some kind of artificial intelligence agent program that will help you deal with information overflow, with attention management. That's where we want to put Quagga. Quagga is where you want to go if you need some help in managing your email and your flow of information. So what we see is we've just started with Rights.net. We see it going to hundreds of thousands of people with a lot of affiliation deals and that kind of thing. Moving part of the, at least all the marketing product, distribution, commercial stuff to the to Silicon Valley, and then being available on all the platforms. Currently, we're only working with Gmail and Google Apps, and we want to be available on Outlook, on Lotus, IBM, Lotus Notes, and everywhere. Our motto is, you deserve an email assistant, and we want to be that email assistant.
All right. And now, what's your timeline? What roughly? I mean, what kind of project timeline is this?
I think it will take something like 3 years to go to that vision.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it took us almost 2 years to build the technology, find the first application, find some kind of market fit. Now we have market fit, so we're raising some money first locally in France, and then expand it, make it scalable. Yeah, I think it will be something like 3 years.
Yeah.
But, you know, entrepreneurs are always very optimistic.
Now, in France, you mentioned venture capital. Do you have venture capital in France, and do you have it for Quagga?
Yeah. We have it in France, and we have some seed funding currently from two French venture capitalists, two European, one called Kima Ventures, which does some investment in America too. It's very, very similar to 500 Startups. And the other investment that we have is from Seedcamp, which is very similar to Y Combinator. Seedcamp is London-based, so it's an English company.
Now, are there incubators in France?
Yeah. Actually, we are in an incubator which is linked to the city of Paris.
Oh.
Yeah, it's to start your business, it's a nice place. It's we have incubator, we have broadband access, we have seed financing, we have help from the government, so it's we have a lot of grants, we have very good universities. I think for this first part, it's good. It's when you move to the distribution, commercial, and marketing part that you probably need to expand.
Well, now, when you come to Silicon Valley, will you move your whole company?
No, I'd probably keep all the technological and engineering stuff here for several reasons. One of them is that it's going to sound very strange, but cost of engineer is lower in France than it is currently in the Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And then we have really good engineers. I mean, probably as good as over your side of the mm-hmm. of the ocean. And then our all technical network is there. So we have contact with great laboratories, universities, that kind of thing. We'll move all the marketing, product marketing, management, distribution over your side.
Well, I'm wondering if it would be interesting or helpful, valuable for you to speak to one of my friends who has has an incubator here. I don't know that you'd have to move to work with him, but he might be able to help.
Yeah, sure.
Help you.
I'd love to.
I'd love to think through some of the marketing issues.
Yeah, I'd love to. Really, it's I'm coming over almost every 6 months to see people connect with a potential to do a potential partnership, that kind of thing. I'd love to. I'll ping you when I come over.
Good, and I'll send you an email and introduce you to Firas Bushnak is his name. He has an incubator in L.A. and some of his some of the things he's working with have to do with marketing.
Okay, I'd love to be. You know, I think if there is something in which French people, including myself, are not really talented, it's marketing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something that you guys invented in America. And, there is no salesman like an American salesman.
I think we invented it way back when we invented snake oil, right?
Probably. But then you do it so
fast. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing that marketing is in the United States. Well, now tell me a little bit about how the recession has affected either you or your company or business in France.
Well, since we're almost pre-revenue and are mostly funded by seed funding and government grants, we were not hit too hard by the recession. I think it's traditional business where it's much harder. At the same time, we have, we have a very social state in France, so it kind of softened the depression. So it was not too tough. We didn't see too many layouts and that kind of thing. So that's a good part. The bad part is that with this kind of a welfare state, when it picks up, you don't get all the benefits of the growth of the economy. Mm. So it was not too hard for a startup. What we're seeing just right now is French is really very regulation oriented. So the government has just changed 2 months ago the regulation about investing in high tech company. We used to have a lot of tax cut for this, and they've changed this, so it's getting a bit tougher just right now to raise money at the seed level because of this regulation. But for a small technical company, we didn't see a lot of recession effect.
Oh, that's good.
It's true. My previous company, Cinequa Corporate Search Engine, which is in the 10 million euro turnaround, was it a bit harder because most of their customers were big name blue chip companies. And yeah, we saw a lot of budget slipping, and we're not going to buy software this year. We'll do it next year. So yeah, it was a bit tougher for those kind of companies like 10 to 100 million software companies.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, now, we hear a lot about Greece and the problems there. Is that something that you guys even think about?
Yeah, it's really frightening. It's really frightening because we know that all the great French banks, the big banks, are invested in Greece. It's about Greek debts. And Greece is really, it's not far from France. And so it's really frightening to see a whole country that could go bankrupt. Mm. And we know that, I'm speaking mostly for myself, but for the people I know, we really think that we all have to help Greece not go into bankruptcy. But we also know that it will, at one point, we'll have to pay for that.
Yeah.
Either in taxes or maybe a wage reduction, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's really frightening.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as frightening as the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, that kind of thing.
As what?
As the, all the problem with the, you had a few years ago with Lehman bomb going down.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, so it could be something like what happened in the United States.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We feel it's really dangerous. I mean, France economy is pretty good. At the same time, we really we have a strong debt, a very, very important debt. So it's, I don't see it day to day, but it's something we are aware of and probably a bit anxious here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, what other things would you like to tell people here? If you sometimes we end the show with giving the guest the microphone in a minute, and what would you like to say to people, business people in the United States?
I would say two things. I would say France is a great market. It's a big market, 60 million people, very educated workforce. It's a great place if you want to start your implantation in Europe. And I would say to the venture capitalist, if you're looking for very smart companies with a technological breakthrough and which are priced at which are not as high as in the Silicon Valley, France is a place to look.
Good. Excellent. Listen, Philippe, this has been wonderful. Isn't Skype great?
Yeah, Skype is great, and I mean, it's really the image of globalization. I mean, I'm in Paris, it's a beautiful sun, it's the end of the afternoon, and I'm talking to you you're in L.A., right?
Oh, yeah, south of L.A., on the coast, in Laguna Beach.
Wow, so nice. So it's incredible. So thank you for having me on your show.
Well, sure, and let me know when you're coming over, and let me know when you're moving, and we'll find an apartment for you.
Okay, thank you. Thank
Good.
You very much.
Excellent. Well, thank you very
Bye-bye.
Much, Philippe.
Yeah, thank
Take
you.
Care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And so there we have some very interesting conversation about business in the United States and what it means to make it through, reinvent yourself, take a look at new opportunities, stay focused on the goal. At the same time, we have some interesting input from France and hearing what it's like in Paris. Very different in development environment. I thought it was interesting to recognize that for startups, France provides a very nurturing environment. But when it comes to marketing to the world, you might have to take that startup and move it to Silicon Valley because Americans seem to know how to market. Interesting. Very interesting. So all these we find out wandering up and down the 405. So from the Pilgrim, glad to be with you today. I'm glad you were with us. Look forward to being with you again next week when we see what else we can find from wandering up and down the 405 here in Southern California. Make it a great day. Make it a great week. Get out there and find those opportunities. They're waiting for you. So this is the Pilgrim in Laguna Beach, California, saying take care.
Whoops, well, the music didn't play here, so I'm going to play something else. Let's play the Sandler Belief Song. How about that one?
The Belief Song, courtesy of Sandler Training. All the strength, all the courage, it's just me who cannot see. My mind is always listening to the things I do, to the things I say. Sometimes something's missing, 'cause I can when I think I can. I'm more than I think I am. Do the things that I can say. The old me, a victim of other victims. Sleepwalking, never talking, not knowing where to begin. But no more, you can't talk into me. I said, wake up, I said, listen up, I can choose what I believe. 'Cause I can, when I think I can. I'm more than I think I am. I can, when I think I can. I am, I am, I am. The only eyes speak into me. True, only the good, only what I wanna see. And I get to decide if I believe I'm noble, I'm brave, whatever makes me feel alive. 'Cause I can when I think I can. I'm more.